I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is The Way We Live Now. Today is day 99, since many of us have slept through the night, and day 47 of this podcast. I've been haunted by stories during COVID-19 of people dying alone in hospitals with no one holding their hand, families who've been unable to properly grieve or undergo the age-old rituals of mourning, all of which involve gathering. My guest today is Brian Mark Word, the obituary editor at the Boston Globe. Brian, thank you so much for joining me to talk about The Way We Live Now.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Can you describe for us in sensory detail where you are right now as we're having this conversation?
Sure. I live 2 hours north of Boston. I live in West Lebanon, New Hampshire, about a mile and a quarter south from the Dartmouth College campus. And I am in my house now. I actually was ahead of the curve and working from home, and have been and made an arrangement to work out of the office most of the time about 10 years ago. I'm actually near my home base. I have a sofa that I sit on that has a picture window next to it that I look out at my cul-de-sac in the neighborhood. And I have bears who walk through the backyard. And when I'm lucky, I get to see them. So.
Wow. That's interesting that you were ahead of the curve by 10 years and that, you know, working from home is not something that's new for you.
It isn't, but as with everything, everything else in our world with the pandemic, so much changed in what I do when the pandemic hit.
Right.
While I may have already been home and, you know, able to work in hoodies and jeans rather than dressing up for an office, I have seen dramatic changes in what I've done, as I'm sure has everyone who writes obituaries for a living at other papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Right. So you are the obituary editor at the Boston Globe, and you've written well over 2,000 obituaries of those who have died in the past 14 years or so in the state of Massachusetts.
That's correct. And occasionally I write about people elsewhere in New England, and even more occasionally, once in a while, someone who had done something significant in her or his time in Boston. The significance was such that we decided that the Globe should still feature them in a staff or a news obituary after they died. Mm-hmm. But mostly it's people in Massachusetts. Mostly it's people in Greater Boston. Mm-hmm. The requests, of course, come in from everywhere. Anyone who spent a few years in Boston, sometimes their family will reach out to me and ask for an obituary when their time arrives.
Right. What is that like, being on the receiving end of people who are in the really, really early stages of shock and grief, reaching out with that sort of ultimate feeling? I mean, I've been there myself, of wanting a loved one's life to be honored.
It's the biggest and most important part of my job, and I don't say that lightly. I think the easier thing to look at and to consider with an obituary writer is what you write and what is published. And that is an enormous part of my job. But the most time-consuming part of my job is going through all of the requests and largely being the person who has to make a lot of the choices about who gets a news obituary in the Globe and who doesn't. I write roughly 150 obituaries a year. And I say no to roughly 600, 800 a year. Sometimes that can be as easy as just a note saying no to the funeral home. Many funeral homes will send just about everyone your way, even when they know there's not that much chance. But in some cases, it involves phone calls with families, email exchanges with families, multiple phone calls with families if they really, really want this to happen. And I'm always mindful that even when I have to say no, I'm saying no to someone who is in a moment of intense grief, who's just lost somebody that they love. And I too have been through that. And in fact, really decided that I wanted to try to write obituaries for a living after I had gone through a period in my family of losing multiple people in 1.5-month period. So I know the kind of grief that they're experiencing. And so that means those conversations are all as gentle as I can make them, even when I'm saying no, and as informed as I can make them. I want all of the families to know that I've considered their requests fairly and thoroughly before deciding one way or the other.
What are some of what goes into making that kind of decision? I mean, certainly there's the deaths of people who are public figures where there's a sense of course, you know, the paper of record is going to cover their death. But what are some of the other criteria that go into weighing?
Sure. Yeah, it's as I tell people, there's no easy set formula. Some of what goes into this is, frankly, what time of year the requests come in. People who work in funeral homes and who write obituaries for a living know something that a lot of people don't know, which is that there are actually busy times of year for our lines of work. People will hold on to get past certain key points in their lives, anniversaries, birthdays, the graduation of a child, the marriage of a child, and the biggest clump of holidays that people hold on for are from Thanksgiving through the beginning of the year for all faiths. And a lot of people, even when their health is failing, will try to hold on to get through that. So there's always an uptick in the number of requests that begins right after Thanksgiving. And then, you know, there's an upward slope of more and more requests. And then there's just a whole ton of requests right after the beginning of the year. So at that time of year, the ratio of obits that I can say yes to and the ones that I have to say no to is much more significant and severe. In all times of the year, I'm along with looking at the lives of the people whose families have reached out for an obit, I'm trying to be mindful of what our obituary pages are going to look like. I have really tried in the 14 years in this job to make the Globe's obituary pages look more like Greater Boston and Massachusetts, which has become even more diverse in the 14 years that I've been in the job. And obituary pages always have been predominantly older white men because they're the ones historically in the top of the power structure, and they're the ones who have held the jobs that are most likely to make them must obituaries. If you were a prominent politician, if you were the president of the bank, if you were head of the school committee, the list goes on and on for all of the professions. If you had that job 30 years ago and then are now in your 70s or 80s and at the age where you need an obituary, you're probably a white guy. Mm-hmm. So that section is almost always and is still mostly, you know, the must obituaries are still mostly older white guys. So for all of the other obituaries that I can write in a year, I try very hard to make sure that I'm looking at demographics that have not been featured as prominently in the past. Mm-hmm. Women, people of color, people in the LGBTQ community, people who aren't as well off financially, people who have no connection with Harvard and MIT, and people who have a connection with one of those two major institutions have historically constituted a lot of the news obituaries in the Globe. And so I try to make sure that I reach out beyond them too.
Mm.
And that's not easy because, you know, when I say this, for every obituary that I say yes to, I have to say no to a lot of people. And saying that you want to make the obituary pages look more like Boston and making it happen means that you have to say no to a lot of families. And a family whose loved one is an older white guy who led an admirable and accomplished life doesn't necessarily want to hear that it would help the globe, it would help the community to make sure that all people are recognized. Mm-hmm. You know, when your loved one dies, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but your politics go out the window. You want your loved one featured in the paper.
Right. So it almost seems like this has a quality of a calling for you. I mean, I understand that from a young age that you knew you wanted to do this, exactly this, not just be a writer, not just be a journalist, but to write the stories of people and honor their lives after they've passed away.
Well, some of it, I think earliest on, I was drawn to the biography form. Mm. I found, you know, I actually had a race with my best friend in third grade to see who could read the most of the biographies that we had a set of in the back shelf in our third grade classroom. And then as I got into newspapers, I realized that I had a reasonably good touch with writing profiles of people. And then when I had the opportunity to write obituaries, I was struck by how much good could be done with a well-written, well-researched obituary. And then the final component of it was that I realized that I had the empathy to speak with grieving people, and not everyone does. I mean, I think many of us who are empathetic think that we're really empathetic, but there's a slight difference between being empathetic with someone you know and being empathetic with hundreds and, over the course of 14 years, thousands of people you will never meet, and in many cases, empathetic with them once in your entire life, mm-hmm. and once in your entire life. And I found that I had that in me, and it seemed to be a good fit for obituaries. And so back in 97, 98, I thought, and at that point I'd had some experience writing obituaries for a couple of newspapers. I thought, well, I should see if I can find a way of doing this full time. Mm. And it took roughly 7 years mm-hmm. to be able to do that.
You know, it strikes me that when someone dies, the shape of their life is complete. Mm-hmm. Memoirists and other kinds of writers always end up talking about sort of lives in acts, you know, like three-act structure. The middle is just one damn thing after another. And the third act doesn't end until that shape is complete. And so mm-hmm. it's so interesting to think about that as a form to be able to really tell the story of someone's life now that it has ended. And I imagine that these last months have had to be so intense. How has your experience changed or been different since the start of the pandemic?
The word intense is very key here. Everything has become more intense. And I have to say that I anticipated that that might be the case. I wasn't quite, even with my anticipation, I wasn't quite prepared for just how intense it all became. I mean, if you speak with grieving people for years and years and years, you get a sense of how world events might affect them when they're on the phone with you. And I had the sense as the pandemic was beginning to unfold that this was going to put us all on edge, and it has. The obituaries that I've written about people who have died of COVID-19 are their own special kind of experience, because it's just a terrible way to die. And the people I interview, the relatives and the friends of those who have died of this, I mean, we all can use, you know, we can all Google symptoms and how things play out with an illness like this. So they know what their loved ones are going through and they can't be with them. Mm-hmm. So it's a particular kind of pain that they're in when they get on the phone with me. That said, death is not sheltered in place. Death has not taken time off. Death by every other means has continued apace. And in many cases, the families of the people who have died of other illnesses, particularly if they're in the hospital at the end, have faced many of the same restrictions as people who have lost loved ones to COVID-19. They can't go into the hospital. You know, they can't hold somebody's hand at the end. They can't hug them. They, and in some cases, can't even talk to them.
Yeah.
I've mentioned this to people as I've had this discussion that, you know, when my father died of cancer nearly 23 years ago, I held him as he took his last breaths. Now, that was an emotionally wrenching moment, but one that I would not trade for anything. I was glad that I could be there. I was glad that because I was the person in the room who could do that, who could stand by the side of his bed, who could gather him up in my arms, you know, even though I knew he couldn't feel or know what was going on, it was important to me and it became important to the rest of the family. That experience is being denied to basically everybody I'm speaking with now. And it's just an awful thing. And it doesn't matter whether your loved one died of COVID-19 or something else. For most people, they're not able to have that experience. And it makes every conversation that much more intense, that much more wrenching.
Right. I know. I've thought about that so often since the start of the pandemic, not just in terms of the numbers of people who have died of COVID-19, but the numbers of people who have died and have died alone, and also the lack of ritual and gathering. I mean, gathering is what we do when someone right. dies. It's what every culture does, is we derive comfort from the rituals if we are, you know, of a particular faith, regardless the people coming with their casseroles and their...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sitting together, whether it's at a wake or it's at a shiva or it's, you know, whatever the culture of the rituals of death are. And what replaces that? I mean, what does it do to our grieving? There are so many people who are grieving right now who are grieving in isolation.
Yeah, I'm concerned, and I would not be surprised if there is a ripple effect over certainly the months ahead and perhaps even the years ahead of, you know, people having to deal with this with therapists, with their clergy, with their friends who are listening. Because when there's such a wide swath of grief denied, that grief will still need addressing at some point. Just being able to cry in front of somebody that you care about and trust is an enormous thing at a time like this. And it has occurred to me that, you know, and I want to be very careful here to not say that I'm replacing anything, but it has occurred to me that in some cases, in some instances, in some conversations, that the conversation with me is giving people a chance to at least get a tiny bit of that back. Mm-hmm. You know, they get to at least talk about it and talk about how difficult it was for them to not be by their loved one's side and to cry, you know, because people have permission to say things and do things on the other end of the phone with me that maybe they don't feel comfortable doing in front of others. Mm. So I'm glad when I have been able to do that, that I am there for those people. You know, it's not an insignificant number. It's not everyone, but there are certainly people who, you know, have really had to be able to talk some of those things out.
Yeah.
And that has happened in conversations with me, you know, and conversations and things that they would say that would, you know, are not meant for obituaries and would not be in obituaries.
Mm.
But they just need to have that conversation.
So let me ask you, I think this is my final question to you, is
sure.
I'm imagining the capacity for that kind of empathy, right? And you just really movingly spoke about the you know, this kind of like one time only, these conversations, these intersections with people that you had never spoken with before and may never speak with again, and showing up for them with the capacity to feel and to listen. But, you know, empathy is in part, you know, defined as, you know, shared feeling. How do you hold that, especially during a time when there is this sheer volume of these grieving and isolated people? You're meeting, you know, in you know, over the phone, you're absorbing some of their story. How do you hold that, and what brings you a sense of strength and hope as you continue?
That's a difficult question, and it, you know, to some extent, you know, my answer will echo, you know, what I had said earlier about choosing people for obituaries, is that there's no particular easy formula for being able to fill that role. I've always said that some of the most interesting and engaging and involving quotes that appear in the Globe are in obituaries that I write, because I listen, and because I open myself up to the grief of others when they need to be able to say things. And I listen for a long time, and I have long conversations with people. And that means putting myself on the line, because, you know, I have to open myself up to them and let their grief wash over me for them to feel comfortable enough saying the things that they need to say that will really truly honor the person that they care about. And then the phone call ends, and I've got all of their emotions swimming through my head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the pandemic, it's been a difficult time. I used to go to the gym 7 days a week because, you know, really vigorous aerobic exercise on the treadmill or elliptical is a good way of burning off some of the emotions that stay with me. And I can't do that now. I've been hiking in the woods as much as I can. It's not quite the same. And frankly, I think I can say that I haven't found a particularly good way of taking in all of those emotions and still being able to, you know, jump up the next day and jump back into things. Mm-hmm. I don't know what and how I'm going to direct all of that after this is done, assuming that there is such a thing as after this is done, which is not entirely clear at this point. But a lot of it is still there. It's a more intense kind of interviewing than I've done before in this job in 14 years. And it's all there.
Yeah.
You know, I've taken on a lot more emotion and pain than I have in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's still with me.
Yeah, I'm listening to you, and thank you for saying that. You know, and I'm thinking the word connecting keeps on kind of occurring to me as I'm listening to you, is that maybe ultimately that sense of profound human connection that happens every single time you have one of those conversations is what the hope is. Like, maybe it's just, that's what it is.
Yeah.
This podcast I started because during COVID, just thinking what connects us, you know, we can't gather, what allows us to feel that uplifted feeling of, you know, one heart vibrating with another. And Anyway, I'm grateful to you for talking with me, and I think everyone is going to really connect to what you're saying and to the work that you're doing. And in Judaism, which is the religion that I was brought up in, there's this phrase that people always say when someone passes away, which is, "May his memory be a blessing." You know, may her memory be a blessing. And really, that's it occurs to me that's what you're doing. So
yes. Yeah, it is. I'm touched back on what you were saying. If I have a calling, it's to It's to make sure that the blessings of these memories are not forgotten and that they have a place to live. Mm. What I do with obituaries, I try to make sure that I am as invisible as possible, mm-hmm. and that instead what I am is an avenue for those memories to find a permanent place out there in the world.
That's beautiful. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Danny. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for listening to The Way We Live Now. Tell us the way you're living now. We want to hear. Call us on, you might want to get a pen for this, 909-713-8995. That's 909-713-8995. And record your story, and we might just use it on the pod. Also, you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/thewaywelivenowpod. We are creating a community here, and we would love for you to join us. You can find me on Instagram at Danny Ryder. The Way We Live Now is a production of iHeartRadio. It's produced by Lowell Berlanti. Beth Ann Macaluso is executive producer. Special thanks to Tristan McNeil and Tyler Klang. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.